bomb the following night at the Thunder tapings. He told folks that this was the 17th concussion of his career, and then, years later, claimed these head injuries contributed to him developing Parkinson's disease. Main event was Goldberg beating Chronic in a bad match. Lesson not learned. The main event just mentioned, where Goldberg had a lousy match with Chronic, was not the only encounter Clark and Adams had in WCW. In fact, most of them were pretty atrocious. Amazingly, this did not stop WWE from bringing them in as a tag team and putting them against two of their biggest stars, Kane and The Undertaker. Yes, that Undertaker, the one that's been one of WWE's biggest stars for approximately 20 years. This feud led to an amazingly awful match at Unforgiven 2001. The match was so atrocious that despite being pushed as a top act, remember, they were battling The Undertaker, they were immediately fired following the match. The Nitro and Thunder tapings the next night in Irvine, California were terribly sad. Nitro, built around Ric Flair's return to TV in the outdated commissioner role, drew, and this is absolutely true, 768 paid fans. Even fans whose only joy when watching WCW was to laugh at its ineptness had to be saddened to see a company that drew 41,000 fans just 2 years earlier doing a number that was below what some independent shows had done that year. Backstage, virtually everyone had just completely given up, and it was quite noticeable on TV. If there was anything that could be considered even remotely good news, Flair's return helped bump the show up to a 2.52. And hey, remember back in the last chapter where we were bemoaning the fact that the average attendance for October of 1999 was 4,200 paid? By October of 2000, that number had dropped yet again to less than 1,800. Yes, a 58% cut into an already horrible figure. In early November, the WWF officially backed off on its negotiations to purchase the company. In fact, Linda McMahon's exact words to Broadcasting and Cable Magazine were, quote, "We're definitely not buying it." Initially, Viacom had been upset with Vince's plan to air Nitro and Thunder on TNT and TBS respectively, since they were rival networks. At the time, this was a serious issue, because with the impending AOL-Time Warner merger, Turner wanted to unload the money-losing company but retain the TV shows. Even though Nitro was doing hideous numbers in comparison to what they did at their peak, they were still above average when compared to ratings of other primetime cable TV shows. Eventually, Viacom relaxed a bit, but what prevented the deal from happening the first time had more to do with how much Turner thought WCW was worth and what the WWF, which had lost tens of millions that year with the XFL, was willing to pay. Over the next few weeks, the lame duck television continued, with almost nothing of any note happening, since the decree was still in effect to not mess with Russo's storylines. The problem with that was that none of the storylines could really advance, and it was obvious to viewers at home that nobody in the ring was giving anything even close to 100%. As a result, the holding pattern on TV did not result in a holding pattern for the ratings, which continued to slide. The November 20th show did a 2.27 rating, the lowest ever in the history of the show, running opposed in its normal time slot. What was sad was that the shows weren't even that horrible and were certainly better than the programs Russo had written at his most insane. It would get even sadder in early 2001, when the shows were actually becoming mildly enjoyable just weeks before the plug was pulled entirely. Unfortunately, by killing off all the belts, and in particular the heavyweight title, Russo had created an atmosphere where everyone was fighting each other for really no good reason. Since the belts had been rendered worthless, there was nothing worth fighting for, and fans had no reason to get behind any of the wrestlers. One thing of note on TV was that Kevin Nash, who in late 2000 was the reigning smartest man in wrestling, suddenly started doing a bunch of jobs and buddying up with young guys like Jindrak and O'Hare. He knew that chances were good that if he put himself over as a great team player, the WWF would show interest in him, either when his contract came due or if they bought WCW outright. It became quite humorous watching the lengths he would go to be seen as, quote, a good guy. A few weeks earlier, the WWF had put tickets on sale for their biggest show of the year, WrestleMania X7, to be held April 1, 2001 at the Houston Astrodome. On the first day they were available, 48,395 tickets were sold. In late November, tickets went on sale for WCW's biggest pay-per-view of the year, the granddaddy of them all, Starrcade. On the first day they were available, 926 tickets were sold. The November 22nd Thunder was notable for being the birthplace of Booker T's new catchphrase. For historical purposes, the first time he ever uttered it, it went like this. I've got six words for you. Don't hate the player, hate the game. The WCW Mayhem pay-per-view on November 27 from Milwaukee, Wisconsin was similar to all the recent WCW TV. It was just a show. There were a few good matches, a few bad matches, and everything in between. The 2,871 people who paid to get in sat there and watched, reacting little to anything that happened. Several titles changed hands. Crowbar won the hardcore title over Reno and Big Vito. General Rection beat Landstorm to win the U.S. title. Nash and DDP beat Sean Stasiak and Chuck Palumbo to win the tag team titles. And Scott Steiner beat Booker T to win the world title, with his Steiner recliner finishing hold. Nobody seemed to care much at all, although they did inexplicably cheer loudly for heel Steiner when he beat babyface Booker for the belt. It was a bad night for poor Booker, as not only did he get booed, but he cracked his sternum taking a full Nelson drop from Steiner in their match. The next night, the big storyline was that Flair was going to fly in this huge superstar to face Steiner at Starrcade. He even went as far as to claim that this man was as big a superstar as Rock or Steve Austin. The man ended up being the self-proclaimed master and ruler of the world, Sid Vicious. For reference purposes, we checked with sources in Washington, D.C., and Sid was not, in fact, the master and the ruler of the world. The storyline was that since he had to give up his belt in April for no good reason, when Russo vacated all the belts, he deserved a chance to get it back. Yes, a rare, logical storyline. Unfortunately, there was no logic in the interview, as Mr. Sid Vicious accused Steiner of having, quote, a fictitious name. Nash was also back to his old not-caring ways, as he did another interview accompanied by Dallas Page that put over Scott Hall. This was particularly bad timing, since later that very day, Hall had been involved in another DUI auto accident. Claimed at the hospital that he hadn't been drinking, then immediately failed a sobriety test at three times the legal limit of 0.08. Main event was Steiner beating Booker's brother Stevie Ray in a WCW title versus career match, so Stevie had to retire forever afterwards. Earlier in the show, Stevie hyped up the match by not only calling Steiner synthetic, seemingly an accusation of steroid use, but also a sad sack ass fruit booty and a sad sack cracker jack, seemingly accusations of, well, we have no idea. The match itself was truly atrocious, as Stevie became so exhausted within a matter of moments that he was unable to perform tasks as simple as lifting his leg up in the air. It turned into one of the worst matches in Nitro history, a fact not lost on the tiny audience. The following week on Nitro, they did an angle where Steiner attacked and destroyed Arn Anderson. When Goldberg tried to make the save, Luger waffled him with what was actually a great chair shot. This led to Flair ruling on Thunder that Steiner and Goldberg were both being sent home, which was hardly the brightest thing to do since they were both main eventing Starrcade that weekend. He also announced that Steiner was being stripped of the belt for his actions on Nitro, which was unbelievably stupid given how badly the belt had been tarnished already. Thankfully, that ended up being just a storyline, as Arn, in a great interview, talked Flair into rescinding that decision. He didn't, however, rescind the decision to send Goldberg and Steiner home, which resulted in many fans getting up and going home themselves. On December 8, Brad Siegel met with all the WCW department heads and stated point blank that WCW was for sale. Even though everyone knew this was the case, he never admitted it in previous meetings, saying only that Turner was entertaining offers from people who wanted to buy it. This was, however, pretty much all the information he provided, so everyone left the meeting in the same state of confusion and uncertainty they were in before it started. The December 11 Nitro was a disaster for reasons having nothing to do with what happened inside the ring. Months back, a David Copperfield special was scheduled to air that day, so Turner executives had bounced the idea back and forth about moving Nitro to Tuesday. On November 6th, Craig Leathers, who was head of production for WCW, sent Terry Taylor a letter informing him that it was going to be moved. Taylor supposedly never told anyone about it. So on December 7, the Friday before Nitro, everyone suddenly figured out that Nitro wasn't going to air on Monday, and they hadn't mentioned a thing about the time change on the previous Nitro or Thunder shows. The show itself was chock full of nothing, except for the hilarious closing angle. Sid beat up a valet and stole all his keys, then drove a bunch of cars into a circle so he could fight Steiner in the middle of it. Sadly, the footage of Sid attempting to match 20 keys to 20 different cars was never aired on the program. The Scott Hall story of the week was that he was arrested for kicking in the door of a taxi cab after the driver told him he wouldn't accept payment via credit card. Even though he'd been fired, Kevin Nash and Dallas Page had been dropping his name regularly on TV. Following his arrest, head of WCW Legal, Diana Myers, outright banned his name from all company telecasts. This led to another legendary segment on the December 6th Thunder. The show featured an interview with Dallas Page and Nash, conducted by the retired Stevie Ray, that, if there was a real wrestling record book of some sort, should have been listed in it. Nash and Page claimed nobody told them Hall's name was banned, so they talked about him the entire time. During this interview, there was a major lighting problem, and the overhead lamps were swinging back and forth as if they were in the middle of a windstorm. There was also a loud clanging noise as if someone was pounding on a garbage can lid. This wasn't expected to be an issue, because the plan was to edit in footage of Hall to cover up these technical glitches. Unfortunately, when Myers heard about it, she blew a gasket and refused to allow the footage or verbal references of Hall to air. Instead of pulling the segment, they aired it on TV anyway, which meant fans nationwide saw Nash and Page eyeballing this wandering overhead lamp while several dozen words were bleeped, making it totally incomprehensible. Thunder had become the wrestling equivalent of the Ed Wood cult flick Plan 9 from Outer Space. The December 13th show was also a booking lesson in how to kill off a top contender. They actually did an interview where Sid, the supposed top babyface, was so stupid that he couldn't find the arena. He kept calling in from his cell phone saying he was lost. "Guys, can you hear me?" he asked in at least three different segments. Clearly, nobody in the company ever learned that the one thing fans will absolutely not support is an idiot babyface. The week of December 18 saw everything go to hell, as both participants in the Starrcade main event were stirring up problems behind the scenes. First, Sid walked out, unhappy about being asked to lose to Steiner at Starrcade. He claimed he'd been promised the finish would be a double countout, but then WCW double-crossed him and changed it to him getting pinned. He told people that he wasn't ultimately upset about the change, but rather about the fact that nobody was man enough to come up and tell him to his face, instead of just handing him a piece of paper with the new plan written on it. In the end, Sid agreed to lose, and plans to change it to a three-way so someone else could do the job were scrapped. Then, the big fight. It started with Steiner cutting one of his now famous unscripted promos, this time on Dallas Page. It was always funny to hear company officials get upset about things like this because historically, it was entirely their fault. Steiner, for example, had never really been reprimanded for his behavior. If anything, he'd been rewarded time after time after time. Earlier in the year, he buried Flair in an unscripted promo and was told by management that it was one of the best interviews of the year. Months later, he threatened Terry Taylor and was rewarded with a paid vacation over the weekend of July 4th. So his antics continued, and instead of being fined or suspended, he found himself the WCW World Heavyweight Champion. If management was upset with his behavior, they had nobody but themselves to blame. Even more depressing, the guys who actually worked hard, behaved themselves, and followed the rules were rewarded by being buried on television, and consequently, they gave up all hope. Steiner's promo against Page included the following line. "Why don't you convince Diamond Dallas Page to get a sex change, so he has the balls to come out here and face me?" Page was stretching in the locker room when Steiner made his comments. Ironically, this was the same building where, earlier in the year, Steiner and Page's wife Kimberly had a verbal incident that resulted in her quitting the company for good. As soon as Steiner said Page had no balls, everyone in the locker room immediately turned and looked over at him, as if to see what he was going to do about it. According to one witness, the air was totally sucked out of the room. Page finished tying his boots and walked down the stairs near the curtain. As soon as Steiner walked backstage, Page reportedly said, "So, I don't have the balls to face you, huh?" They started swearing at each other, and a fight broke out. Steiner took Page down and started to pound on his face, with multiple witnesses saying he went straight for Page's eye. One source said that Steiner had cut his fingernails earlier in the day, and that if he hadn't, it would have been much uglier. The other wrestlers immediately jumped in to break it up, and it reportedly took them over a full minute to pry Steiner off of Page. Page was bleeding and had marks all over his face. He later told friends that Steiner wasn't just scary, he was a killer, and that he was glad he walked away from the fight alive. Page and Nash immediately grabbed their stuff and left the building, with some sources saying their last words were, quote, "We'll be back when there are new owners." Steiner then responded by cutting another promo, this time focusing on Kimberly and saying some very bad things about her. Steiner's punishment? He continued to receive the biggest push of his professional career. The final pay-per-view of the year, Starrcade, took place on December 17 at the MCI Center in Washington, D.C., before 3,465 paying fans. It was a decent show, featuring a great opener, a few decent undercard matches, and a shockingly good main event. Page and Nash, whose walkout lasted all of 1 week, beat Palumbo and Stasiak in a surprisingly good match to regain the tag titles, thanks mostly to Page's great job working as a babyface in peril. Goldberg vs. Luger in the semi-main was surprisingly good. And when Steiner beat Sid with the recliner in the main event, the match could only be classified as a miracle. Sadly, by this point, good show or bad, it didn't matter. Starrcade, traditionally WCW's biggest show of the year, did a dismal 0.11. With the year's end came the announcement of $62 million in losses. How did it happen? Hideous booking, and one bad show after another caused pay-per-view buy rates and house show revenues to plummet. Advertising revenues plunged due to Nitro being cut to 2 hours and to the elimination of WCW Saturday Night. Wrestlers, both on TV and in media interviews, buried the company for its incompetence, making fans feel stupid for having supported the product for so long. Countless millions were spent on stupid things. Limos getting destroyed, helicopters, junkyard battle royals, contract money paid to guys who never appeared on television, booking multiple flights for individual people, commercials and newspaper ads plugging the wrong air dates for the shows, and so on. The company had become a money pit, the likes of which had never been seen before in wrestling. And Time Warner was upset. Part 4. The Death. WCW is not a core business for Turner Broadcasting. We've decided professional wrestling in its current incarnation just isn't appropriate for the high-scale, upscale brand that we have built on TNT and TBS Superstation. We're no longer interested in carrying the product. Jim Weiss, Turner spokesperson. Chapter 7. 2001, The Ultimate Swerve. From the beginning to the end, even as Rome burned around them, those in charge of WCW felt that if they had nothing else, at least they'd always have television. While Vince Russo had driven both buy rates and house show attendance into the toilet, many believed the Nitro and Thunder ratings were still okay. Sure, they weren't even in the same universe as the Raw ratings, but many cable shows did less than a 1.0, and most Nitro and Thunder shows were in the 2.0 range. The reality, though, is that Thunder was dipping below the TBS ratings average, and in the last few months, the show's ratings were regularly surpassed by Ripley's Believe It or Not. Things were only slightly better for Nitro, the flagship show. Ratings were above the primetime average for the station, but they were below average in terms of ad sales. Still, while things had declined since the height of WCW's popularity back in the late 90s, there was always the possibility that the company could rebound simply by hitting upon a hot storyline or having a wrestler catch fire with the fans. While it didn't look like there was any chance of either of these happening in the immediate future, it wasn't like they could never happen. After all, this was World Championship Wrestling. This was the organization that had reinvented the entire wrestling industry with the advent of Nitro. It was certainly conceivable that they could do it again at some point. WCW was, if nothing else, a company that survived. It survived times it should never have, like the lean early 90s period, when, on average, less than 1,000 fans came out to each house show. Things would turn around. They always did, and this time would be no different. All the company needed to become profitable again was to find just that right character, that right angle, and the fans would return. WCW's ratings prior to the NWO invasion were flat, people argued, not unlike the numbers the company was doing during the collapse of 2000. Obviously, things turned out fine back then, so there was no reason to expect anything different now. Except that there was. While the numbers in 1995 and 2000 may have appeared similar on the surface, there were major differences. The biggest was that, in 1995, the company had a $35 million to $40 million budget, compared to 2000's $185 million budget. More importantly, they'd never lost more than $6 million in any year, and all of a sudden, they'd lost $62 million in one. This sort of performance was not acceptable. Ted Turner had been approached about shutting the company down several times in the early 90s. He'd always ixnayed the idea because he truly believed that wrestling was cyclical. Plus, because wrestling had been such an integral part of the superstation that gave birth to his media empire, he had a soft spot for it in his heart. Pretty much everyone in the industry believed that as long as Uncle Ted was around, WCW would be safe. But something happened in January of 2000 that shattered this supposed certainty. Time Warner CEO Gerald Levin struck a $183 billion deal with America Online's Steve Case to merge the two companies into what they believed would be the ultimate media superpower. Turner ended up with 3% of the new company's stock and a mostly figurehead job as vice chairman. Suddenly, His days of spending millions at will on frivolities like professional wrestling were finished. In his place were boards of directors, financial analysts, and CFOs looking at the bottom line. These men were going to do something that no one ever had: make WCW fiscally responsible for its actions. And with the company losing money at an astronomical rate, it didn't take long for AOL Time Warner to come to the conclusion that WCW was a hopeless proposition. Therefore, a shocking decision was made. They would sell the company outright. And for the first time ever, there wasn't a damn thing Ted Turner could do about it. At some point, Ted Turner probably regretted having sold Turner Broadcasting to Time Warner in the mid-90s. And although he had voted in favor of the merger, he definitely regretted having agreed to the AOL deal. His woes included a huge stock crash that cost him between $7 and $8 billion. Wrestling fans should take solace in the fact that WCW, as horribly mismanaged as it was, could not hold a candle to the incompetence of AOL Time Warner. Sure, WCW lost $62 million 1 year, but did they ever lose $54 billion in one quarter? I'd rather go back and be with one of my ex-wives than go through this again, Turner once said. It's a fascinating story of how to do everything wrong. I think part of it was that it was just too complicated. If you ever have a chance to merge with AOL, stay away. With the company for sale, and with McMahon having pulled out in late 2000, the door was open for one man, a person who dreamed of autonomous power and the chance to once again turn Nitro and Thunder into ratings gold: Eric Bischoff. Following his first demotion, in September 1999, he spent some time hunting and fishing near his home in Colorado while still collecting large paychecks. Once Russo had thoroughly proven his incompetence, Bischoff was called about coming back. In a 2003 interview on WWE's Bite This radio program, Bischoff tried to shift blame for the death of the company away from himself. The problem with WCW was that it really didn't fit within the Time Warner profile, he said, meaning a lot of senior executives at the highest levels didn't want the company to be there and didn't support it. When I came back, that situation was a lot worse than when I left originally. So I left again, and basically, I was honest with Brad Siegel, who I was dealing with at the time. And I said, "Brad, the company is so screwed up, it's never going to work. I can't fix it. No one's going to fix it. Why don't you let me buy it?" Of course, one question remains obvious. If he claimed that nobody could fix it, including himself, why would he want to buy it? The truth is that the company didn't fit into the Time Warner profile because, thanks in good part to Bischoff, it collapsed and lost $62 million that year. If the company had still been making the kind of money it made in 1998, it would no doubt have fit the profile just fine. And his claim that his idea to buy it was a last-minute decision is false, because he'd been trying to convince Turner to sell since at least late 1998. Bischoff continued, "Siegel laughed at me. He thought I was nuts. And I left again. I went home again. And about 2 months later, they called me back and said, 'If you're serious and you can raise the money, we'll talk to you.' So I raised the money. And we had commitments for $63 million from some of the biggest blue-chip investment banks on Wall Street supporting us and some very, very smart people. And we spent about 6 to 8 months going through a process called due diligence, where you do all the things you would need to do to buy a company, going through the books and making sure the documents are all in order, and all the legal crap that goes along with it. We had a deal in place. A letter of intent had been signed. Everything was going fine." So fine, in fact, that on January 11, 2001, Bischoff and his investment group, Fusion Media Ventures, announced that they had purchased the company. When we say announced, we mean that they told everyone. They told the press, they told everyone in the company, they told their friends, they told their families. A few noted the coincidental timing of the announcement, which came just hours before the AOL Time Warner deal was finalized. wrestling fans can rest assured that we will give the WCW the adrenaline shot it needs to once again become the most exciting brand of wrestling in the world, Bischoff stated in a press release. Yet, buried in all the hoopla and excitement was the tiny little part about how the sale wouldn't be finalized for 45 days or so. Also buried, the fact that Stuart Snyder, who was working for the WWE as their president and COO at the time, told cohorts within the company there was, quote, zero chance Bischoff was going to wind up with the WCW in the end. That seemed very odd, considering the press release and everything else stated publicly by both Bischoff and Turner at the time. However, Snyder had worked within Turner for years prior to his arrival in WWE in June of 2000. Interesting. Regardless, everyone seemed to have the same question. How could Bischoff possibly turn the company around now when he couldn't before? And, more precisely, how could he do it now that he actually had to be fiscally responsible to his investors? The days of going to Turner himself were now long gone. So exactly how he planned to revert WCW back to its number one position had everyone more than a little perplexed. Not that it mattered to Bischoff himself. This was his chance to prove that he wasn't just a one-trick pony, that the success he'd created with the NWO was just the tip of his creative iceberg. He felt, even with a depleted roster in comparison to the glory days, that he still had the talent to get him there. He just needed time and good booking to push him over the top. He brought in John Laurinaitis as his head booker. Laurinaitis had been lauded for his creative match scripting, and he also knew the business inside and out, having worked for virtually every wrestling promotion on the globe. If anyone knew how to properly book a promotion, it would appear to be him. Bischoff had grandiose plans. There was going to be a brief shutdown, perhaps as long as a month, and then a huge, fresh restart. He was going to push the cruiserweights to the moon. He was going to set up a salary system similar to the WWF's, whereby guys would be paid downside guarantees, then bonuses based on how successful house shows and pay-per-views were. He didn't want to fall into the trap of guaranteed contracts again. He said he was going to phase out the older guys and push the younger guys harder. He was going to open relations with Japanese companies, including Ultimo Dragon's Toriumon Group, to introduce American fans to new, hot, high-flying stars. And perhaps, best of all, he vowed there would be no more Russo. Basically, he said all the right things. Wrestling fans, however, did not care about all the right things being said. They wanted to see action. With the major booking duties delegated to others, Bischoff began to look at the roster for anything he could trim. If he was going to own the company, that meant that he and his investors would now have to foot all of the bills. No longer could he afford to pay his friends exorbitant salaries due solely to friendship. He was going to have to make the company work as a business, and realistically, the high pay rates demanded by the likes of Hulk Hogan, Kevin Nash, and Scott Hall didn't fit into his budget. So not only was the rise of such guys as Steiner and Booker T coming at the right time, but he had to make them the top stars even if they hadn't caught on yet. Financially, he had little choice. His first major plan was to do a company shutdown following the February 18th Super Brawl pay-per-view. The idea was to take several weeks off to build new sets, write new storylines, and get everything set up for a brand new beginning on March 12th. Time Warner, however, said no. Ratings had dropped to such a degree that WCW had to make good to advertisers. 1 month with no TV whatsoever would cost them some serious cash. And with the company already losing tons of money, that was out of the question. If you're wondering why Turner cared about a company they didn't own losing money, it was because the 45 days were not yet up and the sale wasn't completely finalized. Everyone figured it would happen within the next week or so. Bischoff, therefore, came up with what he thought was an ingenious storyline. He'd have Steiner, still the top heel and heavyweight champion, take out all the remaining babyfaces one by one, leaving only Dallas Page. They'd headline the March 18 pay-per-view in Jacksonville, and then, the following night, the, quote, new WCW owners would be revealed and save the day by bringing all the babyfaces back at once. WCW would then scrap the April pay-per-view, so they'd have 7 weeks to build up to their biggest show ever on May 6th, when the entire company would be reborn. In late February, Bischoff reconsidered his ingenious idea. The ratings were sinking fast, and he didn't think he'd be able to hold off until May before reintroducing the major stars. Despite a few changes, programming still ranged from good to awful, depending on the week. Thunder, not yet canceled at this point, was by far the worst, and every program seemed to be an effort to set the record for the worst in history. Sid's promos became more and more nonsensical. Quote, see, there's only two things I care about, and I'm going to see is the man who wins the title and the belt, and that man will be me, he once threatened, or stated, or asked, or something. The storylines were absurd. One week, a masked mystery man bedecked in what appeared to be a bumblebee costume constructed by a 5-year-old attacked Rick Steiner. The next week, he unmasked, revealing himself to be, three guesses, Rick Steiner. On another show, Heavy D sold a neck injury by stating, quote, the doctors told me I can never wrestle again. The slightest thing, and snap, my head could actually fall right off my shoulders. That's sad. Announcer Scott Hudson apparently took him seriously by replying with a straight face that yes, indeed, the fact that his head might spontaneously fall off his shoulders was sad. Perhaps saddest of all was that the main event of that show was DDP versus Jeff Jarrett, and as the ring filled with brawling men following the usual DQ finish, Tony Schiavone screamed, "They won't stop until someone dies!" Guys retired forever on a weekly basis, including Goldberg. Tragically, Sid's career really did end forever when, in a mishap at the Sin pay-per-view in January, he jumped off the middle rope and landed on one leg, shattering his tibia and fibula in one of the most gruesome injuries anyone had ever seen. With no major changes taking place, viewers continued to tune out. In early March, Nitro and Thunder set brand new ratings records. Unfortunately, they were record lows, 2.05 and 1.52 respectively. The investors decided now would be a good time to really investigate the books, and they were not pleased with what they discovered. In fact, to put it gently, they totally freaked out. Time Warner then freaked out because potential brand new owners freaking out didn't sound very promising. The deal, which still had not been finalized, nearly fell through. Fusion's lead investor, Warburg Pincus, began to realize that this was a company that was in deep, deep debt, with tons of lawsuits on its hands and a fan base departing in droves. In fact, the only real assets the company had included a name that had been horribly devalued by years of bad booking, several high-priced superstars who weren't cutting the mustard, a large tape library, and the fact that, once upon a time, it had a hot run. These were not generally considered valuable assets. Pincus, suddenly wondering why anyone in their right mind would invest in this company, hit the bricks. Once they pulled out, Fusion, which had been offering around $70 million, cut their offer almost in half. Their new plan was to offer $5.7 million down, then $2.15 million per year for 20 years. Yes, they believed they could keep WCW in business for 20 more years, or more likely, that they could convince Time Warner that they could keep it alive for 20 more years while simultaneously looking for a new parent company to sell to. And then it happened. A new adversary entered the fray, and it was an adversary that nobody in wrestling had ever even heard of. This man, however, would single-handedly change the entire course of pro wrestling history. His name was Jamie Kellner, and he was the new chairman and chief executive of Turner Broadcasting Systems. Kellner was not new to the television industry. He had, in fact, been the driving force behind the creation of both the Fox and the WB networks, as well as Fox Kids. He was a strong advocate of television targeted toward the young female demographic, which led to the creation of shows such as Seventh Heaven, Dawson's Creek, and Gilmore Girls. He also stirred up a hornet's nest when he stated in a 2002 interview that personal video recorders, TiVo at the time, DVR today, which allow viewers to skip commercials, were tantamount to stealing from the networks. If folks didn't watch the commercials that the networks aired, he reasoned, they therefore wouldn't buy any products, and if they didn't buy any products, advertisers would stop paying for future commercials. Strangely, Keller did not go on a crusade against the remote control. His wacky, industry-polarizing views and theories, however, were simply his way of looking at the bottom line, and that was a huge problem where WCW was concerned. But that wasn't even the biggest problem. In addition to WCW's excessive financial losses, wrestling just wasn't the type of program Kellner wanted on his network. It was low-brow, low-rent. Even when ratings were sky-high, selling ad time on the programming wasn't the easiest thing to do. Car manufacturers, such as Lexus and Toyota, would balk at spending precious ad revenue on folks that they imagined were driving around in 15-year-old pickup trucks. At the end of the day, the fact was that Jamie Kellner simply didn't like pro wrestling. And so, in his very first week on the job, Kellner simply ruled that all wrestling programming was to be canceled on TBS and TNT. No more Nitro, no more Thunder, nothing. This no doubt led Bischoff to this articulate conclusion. Oh, fuck. Oh, fuck, oh, fuck, oh, fuck. This was not good. To say Bischoff was banking on those time slots would be like saying WCW lost a few bucks in 2000. How could this happen? Wrestling had been on the Turner networks for 29 years. It was a legacy, for God's sake. How could one man, some corporate suit at that, come in on his first week and put an end to a relationship that had lasted so long? This could not be happening. It could not be happening. None of the wrestlers believed it. After all, why would they? For 6 years, Bischoff and his cronies had booked storylines designed to fool not only the fans, but also the wrestlers and company employees. The company had often done this in years past, from the Ric Flair heart attack to fake fights in the back, to Hogan walking out in the middle of matches. The theory behind doing this, it seemed, was that if they could fool their own employees, they'd really shock their audience. Why, you might ask, would the company continually lie to its employees? Because in 1996, Bischoff and Brian Pillman briefly had everyone in the wrestling world talking about the fact that Pillman was out of his mind. The former Flyin' Brian morphed into the loose cannon, a madman who could not be controlled and would say or do anything he wanted on television. He, quote, went against the script. He had, quote, real fights with the bookers on live pay-per-view. And what was the end result of this pioneering shoot angle? The wrestlers, upon discovering that they had been lied to, stopped trusting management. $0 were made by anyone other than Pillman, who got to plug his 900 phone line on Nitro. With everyone in a tizzy, Pillman convinced Eric to give him a real-life WCW release to make the angle, quote, seem more legitimate. Upon receiving the very real release, Pillman immediately signed with the WWF. So the wrestlers figured this whole WCW sale was just another swerve by Bischoff, an attempt to shock viewers into thinking they had lost WCW forever, only to bring it back again when it seemed things couldn't get any more bleak. The boys knew Bischoff's modus operandi, and also figured that Vince Russo, another swerve-happy booker, was likely in on it as well. It didn't help that on March 16th, Brad Siegel sent everyone a memo that basically outright lied about what was going on. In early January, we told you about an agreement that we had reached to sell WCW and its related assets. At the time, we said we would appraise you of any changes to the way WCW operates. Effective Tuesday, March 27th, WCW programming will begin a period of hiatus. During this hiatus, WCW will review its programming plans and determine the course of future WCW-branded entertainment events. On Wednesday, March 28th, please plan to attend an all-staff meeting at 10 a.m. at the power plant, at which time we will share with you further information regarding WCW plans. In the meantime, I hope that you will maintain the level of professionalism that distinguishes our organization, particularly as we prepare for the upcoming Panama City, Florida event. And so Bischoff watched his dream fall apart right before his very eyes. The company he'd made was now being pulled away from him just when he thought he had it in the palm of his hand. It was scramble time. No way was he letting his baby get away again. Not this time. Not when he was this close to having it all for himself. Bischoff raced from network to network in the hopes of landing a television contract for the company. Even at the end, Nitro had drawn strong ratings compared to your average cable fare. So there had to be a network out there that would help foot the bill for the company. SFX? No. USA? Barry Diller, head of the network that hosted WWF programming for 18 years, said of the WWF's tenure, "An audience of 12 to 19-year-old, pimply-faced, mean-spirited males came, watched, and went on to whatever god-awful other pursuits." That would be a no. That left just one last possibility. Fox. Bischoff had been negotiating on and off with the network for over a year. One of his original plans was to create a spin-off group with their own TV show on Fox to build up to an eventual interpromotional feud, something he'd been wanting to do for years prior. As a last-ditch effort, Bischoff tried to reopen negotiations in late March, but unfortunately, to no avail. So on March 20, 2001, Fusion Media Ventures announced that they were pulling out. "Once you took the television part out of the deal," Bischoff said years later, "it really wasn't worth anything. Without television, that company wasn't worth anything to us, so we walked away from it." And hey, remember when we mentioned Stuart Snyder earlier? Around this time, the WWF flew him in to Atlanta. Why? Why do you think? "The most surreal moment was flying into Atlanta on the WWF jet," Snyder says. "I said, there's no way we're going to keep this quiet, flying on a WWF jet into the home of Turner Broadcasting." Sure enough, their limo driver asked if he was there to buy out WCW. He simply smirked. Interesting. Even upon cancellation of the shows, with the end drawing ever nearer, many wrestlers refused to believe the truth. Siegel's memo didn't help. The fact that WCW never told them anything in the weeks leading up to the final program didn't help. The fact that on the final Nitro, instead of saying it was over, the announcer said it was simply, quote, "the season finale," didn't help. And most of all, the fact that the company had been trying to work all of its employees since the mid-90s didn't help. This makes little sense to those outside of wrestling, but a stunning number of performers within WCW, despite having read news stories about how their show was being canceled, thought that this was just another big con, and that everything was going to turn out all right in the end. It didn't. And the only reason those wrestlers finally came to understand that they weren't being worked is because they stopped receiving paychecks. What killed us was a combination of bad management and, honestly, no, it wasn't a combination. It was just bad management, said a longtime, high-ranking WCW official under the request of anonymity. I would say booking, but that falls under management. The frustrating part was even at the end, the revenue streams were there. People were spending money on our product. But AOL Time Warner just wanted out. With proper management, with time, it would have worked. Revenue was there. The death of WCW was a sad, very sad day for two reasons, noted J.J. Dillon. For me, personally, it wasn't as bad as for many others. I had a long and successful career, and life goes on. It was sad for the 70-some wrestlers that were earning a full-time living in the business that were suddenly out of a job. I personally feel that it would have been in Vince McMahon's long-term best interest to have the company remain in business. They were never a serious threat to what was then the WWF, and it was a pool of talent that Vince could draw from as the better performers became available and filled a need within the WWF. The other reason is that it was a sad day for Ted Turner. He truly loved the business and his wrestlers, but with all the mergers, Ted had the big title, but not the clout to keep the powers in charge of day-to-day operations from pulling the plug on wrestling on their network, as many had expressed a desire to do over the years. For all he had done for wrestling over the years, Ted deserved a better fate. It seemed a shame that WCW should end in such a manner. It had, at one time, a tremendous fan base, the largest the wrestling world had ever seen. Sadly, the egos of men such as Kevin Nash and Terry, Hulk Hogan, Balea, crippled the company by forcing its spotlight to remain focused on them instead of the other, younger stars. This caused many wrestlers, who could have helped WCW usher in a new era, to instead help usher in a new era in the WWF. When they left, so did much of WCW's fan base. Those wrestlers that stayed with the company until the bitter end had lost all their drawing power and were eventually nothing more than another paycheck the company had to write when it could ill afford to do so. Eric Bischoff was also largely responsible for the company's demise. Ironically, he was the mastermind behind the unlikely rise of the promotion, which, after years of mismanagement, was perhaps even more shocking than the fact that he tanked the company in the manner he did. The way Bischoff took the reins of WCW and completely turned it around in 1996 is something that should be studied by every wrestling promoter. He was nothing short of brilliant. Sadly, those same promoters would learn even more by looking at what he did to quickly destroy the very same empire he had built. He had come up with one great idea, the NWO, which he presented over and over and over again, long past the point fans cared about it. He overspent on contracts, and when the ship began to sink, he panicked and overspent to a ridiculous degree on quick fixes like rock bands and celebrities who did nothing to help resolve WCW's primary dilemma, the fact that they were putting on horrendous TV shows, all of which were being presented with Bischoff's approval. By the time Vince Russo came into the company, it was in pretty dire straits. Fans had been abused by WCW for years, which had presented bad show after bad show, and failed to push new stars. When Russo came in, he had the opportunity to turn things around. The first week's ratings showed that fans were still willing to give the company a look. Instead, he not only continued the trend of horrific television, he actually created programs that were far worse than those his predecessors had presented. This was due in large part to his desire to recreate an industry that had worked in more or less the same manner. Two guys don't like each other, people pay to see them fight, for the past century. Despite claims that his creative genius was held back by Turner's Standards and Practices Department, the fact of the matter is that he presented a product that he personally might have loved, but the fan base at large completely rejected. In the end, the final blow to WCW was, as is often the case in television, a decision made by a TV executive in a boardroom. Jamie Kellner had never been to a pro wrestling show in his life. He didn't see pro wrestling for what it really was, a business that could reinvent itself countless times over. He saw it as a TV program with a shelf life like any other. It was the A-Team, or Seinfeld, or Married with Children. It was a show that had done gangbuster numbers for a period, but eventually ran its course. And at the end of the day, he had justification for his actions. This wasn't a company grossing hundreds of millions of dollars. It was a company that had, at one point in the last 2 years, lost more money in 1 month than any other year in its history. If it had remained wildly profitable, like it had been in 1998, perhaps it would still be around today. Instead, it was a company where Hogan, Nash, Bischoff, Russo, and their band of merry misfits sealed the company's fate with nonsensical storylines, historically awful TV, ridiculous overspending, a complete inability to create new stars, and everything else that has been written about in this book. All of these things together made it very easy for Jamie Kellner, in his first week on the job, to look at some pieces of paper, see some numbers, and, after the highs and lows of 13 years under Ted Turner, who, due to a corporate merger, no longer had the power to save it, pull the plug. And that was the death of WCW. Those in charge of the company never predicted that things would turn out this way, and that was perhaps the biggest irony of all. For a company that took pride on fooling its fans and even its own employees, it was WCW itself that got the ultimate swerve. Epilogue 2014. Here Lies World Championship Wrestling, 1998 through 2001. Imagine for a moment that after WCW died, an idea was pitched for a new national wrestling promotion. A promotion that would serve the needs of the former WCW and NWA fans who simply didn't want to watch Vince McMahon's WWE. Imagine, if you can, that the story of this promotion involved hiring Vince Russo as a booker on and off for over a dozen years, trying to run weekly pay-per-views with no national television with which to promote them, trying to work with the National Wrestling Alliance in order to latch onto the prestigious NWA World Heavyweight title in 2002, creating a tag team called The Johnsons, consisting of two men dressed as penises, shooting an angle that involved a midget masturbating in a trash can, shooting an angle that involved a midget pulling a gun on Jeff Jarrett, shooting an angle to start the first ever heel turn of one of the all-time greatest babyfaces in wrestling history, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, which ended up never coming to fruition because Steamboat just disappeared in a thin air, never to return. Shooting an angle to start the first ever heel turn of WCW's lead announcer, Tony Schiavone, which ended up never coming to fruition because Schiavone just disappeared in a thin air, never to return. Booking dozens of performers in the early years who appeared, shot angles, and were never seen again, including, but not limited to, Blue Meanie, Vader, Bart Gunn, Moondog Spot, Viscera, Mike Awesome, Roderick Strong, Jackie Gata, Rikishi, Andrew Martin, a.k.a. Test, Ayako Hamada, Sean Morley, Kim Couture, and Sangriento. Not noticing until after a show that a wrestler had worn a shirt with a Nazi SS symbol on national pay-per-view television. Promoting a King of the Mountain match, which is a reverse ladder match, where, after pinning an opponent and sending him to a penalty box, you must climb a ladder and hang a title belt over the ring. Promoting a reverse battle royal, where all participants start outside the ring and have to fight to be the first to get inside, a task that involves everyone having to pretend they are clumsy and unable to crawl quickly into a ring. Promoting one of the worst matches in recorded history, a holiday Silent Night, Bloody Night hardcore match that included a hanging barbed wire Christmas tree that grapplers took bumps into. Promoting a match with four boxes, wherein three boxes held title shots and one box held a pink slip, which begged the question why anyone would want to open any box and risk their career when title shots were handed out regularly anyway. Promoting countless random pole matches. Promoting a lumberjack cage match, a concept too preposterous to healthily consider for any length of time. Promoting a hard 10 match, wherein wrestlers were encouraged to use weapons, with weapons shots garnering 1 point per usage, and putting someone through a table garnering 5 points.